From the KTOO Newsroom in Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumery. Good afternoon. Today, the U.S. Forest Service announced its public meeting schedule for residents across Southeast Alaska to share feedback on a revised Tongass National Forest Management Plan. The plan will set the agency's priorities for the forest over the next decade or so. The Tongass is the largest national forest in the United States, with more than 16 million acres covering 80% of Southeast Alaska. Forest plans are typically updated every 10 to 15 years, and the last one was completed in 2016. The new plan will influence how the Forest Service balances a range of uses, including logging, recreation, tourism, subsistence harvest, and ecosystem health. In-person meetings are planned from the end of March through early May and will take place in Juneau, Haines, Skagway, and 15 other Southeast communities. You can find time and location details for these meetings at the link in this story on KTOO.org. The Forest Service launched the public process for updating the plan last month with an initial 30-day public comment period and a notice to begin an environmental review. The public notice said the agency will ensure the plan is consistent with two President Trump's executive orders aimed at maximizing mineral extraction and logging in Southeast Alaska, and that a new timber demand analysis will inform logging projections in the plan. The first deadline to submit comments electronically is March 20th. The agency expects to publish a draft revised plan and draft environmental impact statement this fall, followed by a 90-day public comment period. The final plan is expected next May. Community members had the opportunity to meet and ask questions to three Juneau School superintendent finalists during a forum on Wednesday night. As KTOO's Jamie Deep reports, the finalists all focused on building trust and relationships in the district.
About 30 people gathered in the Thunder Mountain Middle School library on Wednesday to meet the three finalists for Juneau's next superintendent. Each finalist had 30 minutes to introduce themselves and answer audience questions. Sean Arnold presented first. He's the current principal of Thunder Mountain Middle School. Arnold previously worked as a superintendent in Nome and Valdez. He was also an administrator for the Matanuska-Susitna Borough School District. Arnold says he has already developed good relationships with many staff members during his almost 4 years as a Juneau principal. He says he would focus on deepening those relationships and building more trust in the community if selected as superintendent.
A big part of who I am is collaboration. You ask any staff that work for me now or have worked for me over the last 30 years, collaboration gets things done. And that, I think, goes a long way for building trust.
When asked about his vision for alternative programs like Montessori Borealis, Homebridge, and Tlingit Culture, Language, and Literacy, Arnold says having choices is part of a robust education system. He says his experience as the middle school principal taught him that the neighborhood school should work with the alternative programs instead of competing with them.
We want them to be just as strong and kind of supported as we do. And it really is kind of working together. Not every student is the same. Not every school has to be the same.
Kevin Shipley presented next. He's the superintendent of the Evadale Independent School District in Texas. Before moving to Texas, Shipley worked as the education director at Sea Alaska Heritage Institute and superintendent of Cake City School District. He says trust is needed to run a school district.
I've been a turnaround specialist. I've come into places that needed help, and trust and relationships is what this is about. Everybody can say education is all these other things, but if you don't have trust and you don't create relationships and you don't make people experts, then you have nothing.
Shipley says not everyone is going to agree with his decisions, but he wants to make sure they all feel heard and valued. With district employees, he says his approach is to support their needs while being realistic about the district's budget.
You have to find staff, and if staff can't live, they're not going to be successful. So we have to figure out ways to make it work, but you also have a budget and you have programs. And again, in order to be able to give you this, but I have to have trust that I'm being transparent and showing you exactly what's there.
Carly Simon is the third finalist. She's a former dean of education at the University of Alaska Southeast. She used to be the superintendent of Alachua County Public Schools in Florida. Simon was previously a finalist for the Juneau superintendent position in 2023. She says she'll work collaboratively with others to lead the district.
I will only build a team with people who will challenge me. I need people to tell me when ideas aren't fully baked. I need them to tell me if I have a blind side. I have no interest in anybody telling me that, you know, everything I do is always perfect and right. I think you need to have a strong team of people who make you better.
Simon says she wants to build trust through financial transparency as well. She says she created a financial data dashboard in Florida and would do the same thing in Juneau if selected as superintendent.
That's just a good practice, is just open all the books. It's all public record. Have as much information as you can so interested people can read the information that's available to them. Then I think you have to have very honest discussions.
The finalists had more meetings on Thursday, an interview with the Juneau School Board and a closed meeting, as well as a forum with district staff. The board has a meeting scheduled this Saturday to deliberate on candidates and plan to make an offer later this month. A new superintendent would start on July 1st. In Juneau, I'm Jamie Deep.
And researchers are documenting black seaweed across 7 communities in Southeast Alaska. They're trying to get a baseline for the seaweed and are looking at whether the important cultural resource should be considered a keystone species. KCAW's Hope McKinney reports.
Black seaweed, Tlok Usk and Tlingit, hasn't been documented much in the past.
It's mentioned everywhere, but it's a paragraph, a sentence in all these different ethnographic studies about Southeast Alaska and about Northwest Coast cultures.
Dr. Kelly Monteleone is an underwater anthropologist at Sea Alaska Heritage Institute.
So really important resource, but nobody spent the time to actually document it. And that's what I was asked to do.
She's working on a multi-year project largely funded by a $350,000 National Science Foundation grant to determine if black seaweed is a cultural keystone species and document its cultural and environmental significance. Monteleone sees herself as a facilitator for the project. She's brought together a team, including several Tlingit and Tsimshian researchers, to help her hold community meetings, to shadow field harvests, and conduct interviews in 7 communities across Southeast.
We want to make sure we have the documentation, especially with things like the increase in mariculture. Not that we necessarily are thinking that people are going to start growing black seaweed, but as they start putting farms in places, is it going to affect people's access of their existing black seaweed harvest locations? As climate is changing, how is that, you know, sea levels are rising. How is that going to affect people's access to black seaweed? Where's black seaweed going to move to?
In recent years, traditional harvesters in British Columbia and Southeast Alaska say black seaweed has become more difficult to find and has been affected by a green slime. Researchers have linked the disappearance from the intertidal shoreline to an enormous hot water mass in the northern Pacific known as the blob that moved from the Gulf of Alaska down to California a little over a decade ago. As temperatures cooled in the following years, British Columbia's seaweed started to rebound, but not like before. And both researchers and harvesters remain concerned that as the climate continues to change, the distribution and abundance of black seaweed is being impacted, affecting community well-being and food security. Charlie Skultka Jr., who teaches arts and culture classes in Sitka schools, says he can't remember a time in his life when he didn't go out and participate in black seaweed harvesting.
It's something that has always been on our table and in our pantry, and it is one of the cornerstone foods to our lifestyle.
The 62-year-old is Haida, Sioux, and Ojibwa. His family migrated to Sitka in the 1950s, and every spring they would take a boat to large rocks offshore and harvest the black seaweed's long, hair-like fronds.
I have seen many changes. I've seen a change in climate. I've seen a change in abundance and also in quality. There's so many factors at play right now that have to do with our ocean harvesting.
Skultka is concerned that changes in water temperature, increased vessel traffic, and sewage discharge into local waters is starting to affect black seaweed. He says that's why Monteleone's research is so important. By talking to harvesters about the changes they've seen over the years and documenting local knowledge, communities can get a baseline for what's going on and make it abundantly clear that it's a resource that people continue to rely on.
It's absolutely a keystone species. It's one of the cornerstones of our diet, as is herring and salmon and all these other resources. To recognize it any other way is foolish. It's been going on for thousands of years.
As costs rise for fuel, rent, and imported groceries across many small communities in Alaska, Skultka says subsistence foods are as important as ever and need to be protected for the future.
It's getting to the point now without doing these things sustainably and being able to practice our subsistence harvesting. Pretty soon, No Alaskans will be able to afford to live in Alaska.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Hope McKenney.
And three Southeast Alaska fishermen have been charged with intentionally sinking their fishing boats in waters near Sitka and Petersburg. Federal law prohibits the deliberate sinking of a vessel that obstructs navigable waters, and each of them are facing prison time and fines. Federal prosecutors say on March 8th of last year, 59-year-old John Fisher of Sitka intentionally sunk the FV Igloo into Sitka Sound. And on August 3rd, they say 40-year-old Joseph Poling of Petersburg intentionally sunk the FV Leeward into Thomas Bay. Then, between September 28th and October 3rd, 65-year-old Tony Van Veen of Sitka allegedly sunk the FV Okisuch into the Sitka Harbor. The men are charged separately, but prosecutors noted all three cases together in a news release this week. The Coast Guard is investigating the cases with assistance from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Coast Guard spokesman Cameron Schnell told KCIW in a statement that Coast Guard investigators turned over evidence to the Department of Justice for prosecution. Snell said sunken vessels can lead to collisions and groundings, endangering lives and property. And he said they pose a pollution risk from hazardous materials that may be on board. Both the Coast Guard and the Department of Justice said they couldn't comment further since investigations are ongoing. Each defendant is charged with one count of obstruction of navigable waters by a sinking vessel. If convicted, each of them faces a mandatory minimum of 30 days and up to 1 year in federal prison, and a fine of up to $25,000 per day for every day the sunken vessel remains in the water. And the U.S. Senate voted Wednesday against a resolution that would have limited President Trump's power to continue war on Iran. Nearly all Republicans voted against it, including Senator Lisa Murkowski. She said Trump should have sought authorization from Congress before launching such a major strike. But in a written statement after the vote, Murkowski said that now that troops are in combat, Congress has little choice but to continue the military operation to destroy Iran's nuclear capability. She says Congress must define the scope of the conflict, hold oversight hearings, and scrutinize war funding efforts. This is KTOO.